Morning, everyone. Hope you had a good weekend. We're coming back rested and excited about power electronics. Assuming that to be the case, let's dive in. So when we left off last week on Friday, we were looking through solving the state plane of this synchronous buck converter. So we've gone and drawn the waveforms here, identified that we had four subintervals per switching period. Two of them, intervals 1 and 3, are just kind of traditional non-resonant intervals where we're just applying a constant voltage across the inductor, ramping its current up or down. And two of them, intervals 2 and 4, are resonant intervals. In both 2 and 4, we have the same equivalent circuit. Both switches are off. Both diodes are not conducting. What we're left with is just the lumped switch node capacitance called C switch and the inductor L resonating with one another. Assume the output capacitor is sufficiently large that it can be approximated as a constant voltage during either of these times, during either interval 2 or 4, which are relatively short. Pretty good approximation. Assume the output voltage is just constant. So with that, we went through and we ended class here on Friday sketching out the complete state plane of one period of operation of the synchronous buck converter. So we had intervals 2 and 4 are resonant intervals where state plane analysis is useful. Tells us that we get these circular arc segments down here at the bottom and up at the top that are the normalized capacitor voltage and inductor current plotted with respect to one another, our state plane normalization with, here we selected V base is equal to VG. And I base is constrained to be V base over R naught. With this normalization, both of our resonant intervals become these circular segments. And becomes useful to plot in this way because we can analyze plots of circular segments pretty easily using Chig and geometry. To get the complete state plane, we added intervals 1 and 3 on there. And as non-resonant intervals, putting them on the state plane doesn't really simplify anything. In fact, it kind of obfuscates a couple things. But we plot them on here just to be able to have the complete converter period on the state plane. When we go to analyze intervals 1 and 3, the state plane isn't going to give us any useful information. And one of the important things to note there is that this angle, for example, let's call it angle theta x and theta y, are not meaningful because these are not resonant intervals. These angles will not correspond to the amount of time that I'm in this interval in the same way that beta will tell me how long T2 is, just normalized by omega naught, and delta will tell me how long T4 is. Theta x, theta y are not useful angles to look at, won't give us any information about what's going on in the converter. Okay? So we won't look at those. We plot these non-resonant intervals on the state plane just to complete it and show one complete period of the normalized capacitor voltage and inductor current. Okay. With that though, we're set up, we've analyzed and plotted the complete state plane. We're set up to go through and solve the circuit. The remaining thing to do is to relate all of the circuit equations in each of these different intervals in order to get some net description of circuit operation. Things like what is the operating point, conversion ratio, output power, other things, and that's what we'll go through and do today. I want to call back to something that we did last class. We had the ZVS condition for this converter. What is required of our waveforms in order to ensure we're able to achieve zero voltage switching of all devices? So here we have two times where we're turning a device on. Normalized waveforms, we would turn on Q2 at this point right here when the current is I2, and we would turn on Q1 down here at I4. And we'd like to do both of those with zero voltage switching. We previously analyzed this turn on, the turn on of Q1 down here at minus I4 current. derived a condition for that and argued that, okay, it's a lot easier to obtain zero voltage switching when we turn on Q2 at this point. Reason being that if we have positive power flow, this should be our peak current, and up at our peak current should have enough energy available to achieve zero voltage switching. It's a little bit harder down here at this negative current because we really only want to put as much negative current into the converter as we really have to obtain zero volt switching. Otherwise, we'd like to minimize this negative current because all it does is increase our RMS losses for the same average output power by IL. So we do have zero volt switching conditions in both interval 2 and interval 4. I said interval 2 is going to be a little bit easier to satisfy, and for any reasonable output power, it's going to inherently happen that we can get zero voltage switching in interval 2, but we'll write them both. So in interval 4, our harder one, we wrote this previously. What we really need is for this radius R4 to be long enough such that when we swing through this arc in this delta angled arc in interval 4, we need to make sure that we get up to at least a normalized voltage of 1, which is saying the voltage on the switch node will make it all the way to VG during this resonance, and we can turn on the device with zero voltage switching. So our ZVS condition was M plus R4 was greater than or equal to 1. I mean, M, the center of our circle, plus the radius has to get me up to here where I can achieve zero voltage switching or go beyond it. And then R4, we can write, looking at the triangle over here, as the square root of J3 squared plus M squared. Okay. We can do the same thing up here in interval 2. Interval 2, we need R2 to be great enough such that from the center, we can make it all the way back to 0. Send the switch node all the way down to 0 before we turn on the low side device. So what we need is M minus R2 less than or equal to 0. And again, from the kind of initial condition of this resonance, we can rewrite R2 as the square root of J1 squared plus 1 minus M squared. Those will be our two zero voltage switching conditions for a given operating point. We'll assume that defines the conversion ratio M, what the input and output voltage are. There are constraints on J1 and J3 for how high this peak current is, I1, and how low this minus I3 is. We have enough negative current to get ZVS on this interval, enough positive current to get ZVS on this interval. If we have enough negative current to get ZVS in interval 4 and some positive average power, I1 needs to be greater than I3 is negative. The magnitude of I1 needs to be larger to get that positive power, so it'll be a little bit easier to obtain that one. So this one usually obtained, and as we saw in the DCM buck converter, if M is greater than 1/2, we get ZVS here in interval 4, even if J3 is equal to 0. That was our DCM operation. If M is greater than 1/2, even with the diode, we can get ZVS. Plug in if J3 is equal to 0. M is 1/2 or greater than M plus the square root of M squared would be 1/2 plus 1/2 is greater than 1. For this first one, if M is less than 1/2, obtained even if J1 is equal to 0, which setting J1 is equal to 0 may give us zero power or even some negative power flow through this. We've got reverse power flow. It's actually a reverse boost instead of a buck converter. But looking at the state plane, we can tell, okay, if M is less than a half, so our center is somewhere back here. Even if J1 is zero, we have this radius that's more than half of the distance between zero and one. So as we resonate back, we'll be able to get zero voltage switching no matter what. Okay. So those are our two zero voltage switching conditions. In the remainder of the analysis, we'll assume that these are held. Whatever our operating point is that we're analyzing, we're getting ZVS on both switching transitions, and this is what the state plane looks like. Right? If we don't, we'd have some hard switching. Actually obtaining zero voltage switching in the converter requires both that we design it in order to have this minimum magnitude of J1 and J3, and also that we time the dead times correctly. Okay, so that T1 and T3 are long enough to allow that resonance to transition the switch node voltage and get us zero voltage switching before we turn on the next device. Okay. So from there, we're going to go through and solve the complete operation of the converter. What we're going to do is write equations for each of these four subintervals about what our waveforms tell us is happening. And then once we have gone through each individual subinterval, we'll bring them all together in an averaging step that tells us what the power is of the converter. Okay. So we'll just start and we'll go through in order. In this slide, we'll do subintervals one and two. So just starting in order, subinterval one is this interval here where the inductor current is ramping up. It begins at minus I4, goes up to I1. Q1 is on, we're just applying a constant VG minus V on the inductor. And it's ramping up over the course of this interval. So it's a non-resonant interval. This trajectory on the state plane doesn't tell us much other than that the current ramps up from minus J4 to J1. So for the non-resonant intervals, like I said, the timing on the state plane doesn't tell us anything. So we'll just start from the time domain. Say the behavior during this interval is just this slope, VG minus V over L. And that transitions the inductor current from minus I4 to I1 over a time interval of T1. So our change in inductor current is I1 minus I4, or I1 plus I4. And that comes from the slope VG minus V times the total time, which is T1. Okay, we're going to combine that together with solutions in all of the other subintervals. For our resonant subintervals, those are all going to be normalized, solved off the state plane. So what I want to do is normalize this equation just so that I have everything in my J's and M's, not some combination of J's and M's are normalized parameters, and V's and I's are non-normalized parameters. So to normalize this, I'll just multiply both sides by 1 over I base. Over here on the right, that gives me J1 plus J4. Taking currents and dividing them by I base, that just gives me normalized currents J1 and J4. Over here on the right, call 1 over I base is equal to 1 over V base times R0. And we've selected V base is equal to VG. So I'll take that V base and divide it into my VG minus V, which will give me 1 minus M. And then what I'll be left with is R0 over L times T1. This line here. Okay, so let's look at this. R0 over L. R0 is root L over C. So if I push this L under the radical, I'll get L squared in the denominator, which will cancel out the numerator and give me 1 over root LC, which is omega naught. So this R naught over L is omega naught, an omega naught times T1 is some angle. From our state plane normalization, omega naught times a time gives us an angle. So I'll have 1 minus m times theta 1 is equal to J1 plus J4 as my equation that comes out of this interval. Again, this theta 1 is not this. This theta x that I drew here is nothing to look at. Theta 1 that falls out of this equation is some normalized angle, technically, according to our normalization, because it is a time times omega naught, but it is not corresponding to anything geometrically on this plot. Theta x is not the same thing. Theta 1 only exists as just T1 times omega naught. Okay. Easy place to get caught up in over-applying the results from the state plane here. To denote this, I try to stick to a variable selection where any sort of time that I normalize that I'm just taking from a non-resonant interval, I'll denote as theta. Theta 1 for interval 1, theta 3 for interval 3. When it's coming off the state plane, I'll give it a Greek letter. So we'll have, as drawn here, beta and delta are two angles that correspond to T2 and T4, but are significant on the state plane. Theta 1 and theta 3 don't show up on the state plane. Okay, make more sense as we go along, perhaps. But so that's the one equation that we get out of subinterval 1. Subinterval 2 is a resonant interval. And in our resonant intervals, we're generally going to get two equations off the state plane. And those two equations, one will come from solving the Pythagorean theorem twice. What is R4 according to the triangle at the beginning of the period and the triangle at the end of the period? And we'll get a second equation solving for delta. Okay, so my first equation I'm going to solve for R4 over here. It's J3, we're in subinterval 2. I'm going to solve for R2 over here. It's 1 minus m squared plus J1 squared. And then I'll solve for R2 over here on the left. It's J2 squared plus m squared. So R2, I can write it two ways, was J1 squared plus 1 minus m squared. On the other side, it was J2 squared plus M squared. I'll just combine these together to get an equation that says J1 squared plus 1 minus M squared equal to J2 squared plus M squared. And then I'm going to write a second equation for this subinterval that solves for beta.
Dr. Kostnet?
Yeah.
Should that radius be squared?
Yep.
Cool.
Correct. Won't change what we boxed here, but
yeah.
Initial equation should be R2 squared. Thank you. Okay, and then we're going to write an equation to solve for beta. This one we could write any number of different ways depending on which trig identities you're comfortable with. You could do law of cosines thing, or we could say that beta is pi minus kind of this angle here, phi1 minus this angle here, a phi2. I'll write it that way. Even within that, you could write it as an inverse sine, inverse cosine. Most direct, I'll write it as an inverse tangent. So beta is pi minus these two angles. These two angles will both look like some j over something in terms of n. So pi minus J2 over M, the arctangent of that, minus the arctangent of J1 over 1 minus M. Writing it this way is not particularly better than writing it as an inverse sine or an inverse cosine or using law of cosines or law of sines to solve for anything here. just one way of writing it. But generally, in these resonant intervals, we'll get two equations that fall out of them, one relating the radii, one solving for the angle. So that's subintervals 1 and 2. The next slide, we'll do 3 and 4. 3 is going to look very similar to 1. 4 is going to look very similar to 2. So again, another non-resonant interval in 3. Look back at our time domain waveforms. We have a slope of minus V over L, ramping the inductor current down from I2 to minus I3. So our equation will be V over L times T is this distance, I2 plus I3. Get V over L times T3 is equal to I2 plus I3. As we go through and normalize that, all the same things are going to happen. I'm going to multiply by 1 over I base on both sides, which will give me J2 plus J3 on the right. On the left, my I base, I'll split it apart. V over VG will give me M. And then R0 over LT3 will give me this theta 3. Then subinterval 4, we're back to resonant interval. We're going to relate R4 at the beginning and end of the period. So J3 squared plus M squared is equal to J4 squared plus 1 minus M squared. And then our equation for this angle delta, write it in the same way as we did in subinterval 2. It's going to be pi minus the arctangent of J3 over M minus the arctangent of J4 over 1 minus M. And that's it for each individual interval. I've gone through and written every equation we can find out of these 4 intervals. What we need now are a couple of equations that tell us that this is an overall converter and it exists at some certain operating point. So the way we're going to do that is to take an averaging step and look at what is the average output current of this converter. Since we've applied small ripple to the output, if we have an average output current, we have an average output power. It's just average I out times average output voltage, V. Okay. So the last main important thing to solve for is what is I out, which is the average value, 1 over TS times the integral from 0 to TS of I out of T dt. Let's hop back to our schematic here. Make sure I label this I out. It's this current here that we're talking about. So since we're averaging over one period, we can use some knowledge of how averaging works and say, okay, by KVL, the output current is IL minus IC out, whatever current goes through this output capacitor. But over one period in steady state, we need to have zero average current in the output capacitor. So the average output current is the same thing as the average inductor current. So this is equivalent to 1 over TS times the integral of IL of T dt in this butt converter, specific to this topology and the arrangement of the output filter. Then to solve this, what I'm going to do is break it apart and find a solution for this integral in each individual switching period. So we'll say this is the integral from 0 to t1 of IL of t dt plus the integral from t1 to t1 plus t2 IL of t dt plus the integral of IL of t from t1 plus t2 to t1 plus t2 plus t3 plus this last one. Start writing this, let's say the sum from 1 to 3 of ti, sum from 1 to 4 of ti. IL of t dt.
Okay. So we'll just evaluate this integral individually in each of these four switching subintervals. Okay.
So then we can go through and do that.
So in interval one, what do we have? Well, we've got this kind of constant slope, straight line. Current progression goes from minus I4 up to I1. It looks like some trapezoid where one end of it happens to be negative. So the average value over that interval is I1 plus minus I4 over 2. The integral is that times T1. So we can plug that in. This looks like I1 minus I4 over 2 times T1 plus whatever happens in subinterval 2. Let's write subinterval 3 first, because that's going to look like the same thing. It's going to look like a J2 minus, I2. Not there yet. Minus I3 over 2 times T1. And then whatever we get in subinterval 4. Okay. So our two linear intervals, just the average value of a trapezoid to get this integral. Then our two resonant intervals, really we need to integrate this sinusoidal component. Back here, we would need to integrate what's under the curve for this sinusoidal progression of the inductor current here. And we could do it that way. There's a simplification that'll make this a lot easier to do if we kind of note how this circuit is operating. So let me first write, give this a name. Let's call this Q2 and Q4. This integral of some current is going to give us a charge. I'll just call them Q2, whatever that charge is in subinterval 2, and Q4, whatever it is in interval 4, it's a charge because the integral of current is charge, right? These two terms we've already written are charges by definition, okay? And what is that charge? For example, Q2 is the integral of the inductor current over time during subinterval 2. Write it this way. During subinterval 2, we're in this resonant operating mode, and this is the equivalent circuit that we've analyzed. The inductor current in this equivalent circuit is exactly the capacitor current through our equivalent switch node capacitor. So I can say this is the same thing as the integral of I sub C switch over interval 2. And the integral of the current going through a capacitor, well, the current going through the capacitor is C dV dt. And if I integrate that over subinterval 2 with respect to time, I get the the integral of this capacitance with respect to voltage is going to give me a C times delta V switch over this subinterval 2. So this total charge is just C switch times however much the voltage changed by, because the inductor current is the same current that's going into the capacitor. So given that, I can say Q2 is equal to C times, well, in subinterval 2, change in voltage, it goes from VG down to 0. So it'll be C switch times minus VG. Then Q4, our other charge here, all the same analysis applies. Only difference in interval 4 is the voltage goes from 0 up to VG, assuming we do get 0 voltage switching. So this becomes C switch times VG. And these two terms cancel out. Q2 is CVG with the negative sign. Q4 is CVG positive. Add them together, they're going to cancel each other out. So we can drop them off. And final equation is I out is just these remaining terms from the linear subintervals. I1 minus I4 over 2 times T1 plus I2 minus I3 over 2 times, excuse me, I have an error here. This should have been T3. Sorry for that. So this idea will generally apply as we go through and analyze our resonant circuits. The current that we're averaging most of the time is going to have some relation to the capacitor current, and we can solve using these charge arguments. It's not always true that they'll exactly cancel each other out and the resonant intervals have no net impact on the average output current. Sometimes there'll be some ratios of one another. There will be some residual left over. They don't just inherently cancel out. You do have to go through this step of seeing how they relate to the waveforms in the converter every time. But rarely will you have to integrate over that sinusoid. Usually find some charge arguments to not have to do that step. So now I've got an equation for our average output current. Just to get that into the same sort of variable space as all of our normalized equations, I'm going to normalize this expression for the average output current. What I'll do is, again, divide by I base. Should get me part of the way there. Since all of my terms are currents, what I'll get is J out is equal to 1 over TS times J1 minus J4, distributing into this term, times T1 plus J2 minus J3. Over 2 times T3. I've still got these times floating around that I would like to get rid of if I want to keep everything in my normalized terms. So what I'll do is multiply by omega naught over omega naught. And I'm going to take one of these omega naughts and distribute it to everything inside the square brackets, which will give me J1 minus J4 over 2. Multiply this T1 by omega naught to get my theta 1. And the same thing on this second term, where I get theta 3. And then my omega naught in the denominator, I'm going to pull out front and multiply this 1 over TS. And over here on the side, I'm going to define something new. I'm going to define a parameter capital F as kind of a normalized frequency. Capital F is the ratio between the switching frequency and the resonance frequency, either in hertz or in radians, as long as they're in common units. So my 1 over TS out front here is equal to FS, my switching frequency in hertz. I'm going to divide that by omega naught. Omega naught is 2 pi F naught. So this will be my normalized frequency F divided by 2 pi left over from having a FS in hertz and an omega naught in radians per second. That is my final result of this averaging step. Expression for my normalized averaged output current in terms of normalized currents and these angles, theta 1 and theta 3. And since they're angles of my non-resonant intervals, they don't exist on the state plane, but units wise, they're angles. Okay, so that's my average output current. We need one more equation, and we'll pull everything together after this. And this last equation is just making everything fit. So now we are talking about some normalized switching frequency. FS normalized by F naught gives us this capital F. In order to figure out what the switching frequency is, we just need to see, okay, how long are all four of our periods, and that'll tell us what TS is. So the last equation that needs to go into solving this is just saying T1 plus T2 plus T3 plus T4 is equal to TS. Okay, nothing surprising there. You all inherently knew this, but we need to put this in, and then we'll normalize it again to get into our same parameter space. So if I multiply both sides by omega naught, over here on the left, what I'll get is theta 1 plus beta plus theta 3 plus delta is equal to omega naught TS, which is the same thing as saying omega naught over FS, which is 2 pi over capital F, according to our definition from the previous slide. And that's it. We've solved the thing. So those are a complete set of equations. So let's see what all we have. So I've got interval one equation. Interval 2, I get 2 more, so I've got 3 equations here. 4, 5, 6, 7 with averaging the output current, and 8 with this normalized period. So I have 8 equations. In terms of unknowns, I want to figure out in solving this converter. What I have the 4 currents, J1, J2, J3, J4, and my 4 angles, theta 1, beta, theta 3, and delta. We've got 8 equations, 8 unknowns, and I can solve that if I define an operating point. And a converter. So to define a converter, I would need like an inductance and a capacitance, C switch, some design that I'm trying to solve, define an operating point, you know, things like M, J out, perhaps capital F. I'm saying, what conversion ratio do you want to look at? How much power should be going through it? What switching frequency do you want, or in some other way constraining which solution you want to look at? So, general, this will be solvable. There is an issue here in that it's not so easy to solve. We have a what's called a transcendental equation set, meaning we've got some combination of polynomial type terms and trigonometric type terms, so these arctangents and potentially sines and cosines. So we're not going to be able to just plug this into like a simple linear system and solve it exactly in closed form. What we can do is numerically solve it without much of an issue. We can kind of navigate through the solution space by plugging in numbers and solving through everything, or we can constrain some parameter in such a way that it simplifies solving through this equation set. It's not always the easiest and most straightforward to go through and solve, but fundamentally it's there. You have your solution now. You may have to do some numerical iteration to find a solution. But because we have eight equations, eight unknowns, these are linearly independent by how we solve them out, it is going to result in a unique solution for any operating point that is possible. Okay. So I'll show an example of that with some MATLAB codes, and I'll post these to the website on the materials page after class. Hop out of here, keep this. So here I have a few different MATLAB codes. This first one is just solving a single operating point in this quasi-square wave buck. And I'm gonna do two things to simplify here. First, I'm gonna assume M is less than a half. Just writing the equations for ensuring that we always get ZVS on the peak current transition. And then the other one I've done here is I've set J4 equal to zero. Hop back to the slides. J4 is this negative current at the end of the resonant interval where the current is negative. If J4 for M is less than a half is anything greater than zero, what it means is we have more negative current than we need to get the same average output. That means we need more positive current and we're just going to have higher conduction losses. As long as M is less than a half, there's kind of an optimal here of saying just set J4 equal to zero. Only give as much negative current as is needed to get the solution in this interval to ensure ZVS. Okay. Only up here, it's saying I wouldn't have something like this where I've got all this extra negative current. I would push this whole purple waveform for IL up until it's only as negative as is absolutely necessary to get this zero voltage switching in subinterval 4. Okay. It'll minimize my conduction losses required to get ZVS. So even with that, in order to solve this, one way is to take a guess. So here I just said, let's pick arbitrarily an I1, some peak current before we go into the zero voltage switching interval with the positive current. But with J4 constrained to zero and some pick for I1, then I can just step through this equation set. So this defines the normalization. And then I can start with interval 4. If I know J4 and J1, then I can solve J3 and delta. With those, I can solve J1 and theta 1. And with all of that, I can solve J2 and beta. And finally, theta 3, go through the averaging and complete period step, and then here I'm just denormalizing and plotting things. For example, run this, make these a little bigger. I'm showing here in this plot are three things: the time domain, inductor current, and switch node voltage, and then the state plane, my M versus J state plane for the circuit. So this was with some value for inductance and switch node capacitance, and with just a guess at what I1 is, it solves through and tells me the average output current is somewhere around 4.5. I can change that around by changing I1. Resolve this, gives me a lower average output current. You can see this state plane is solved for J4 is equal to zero. So as I go through this resonance down here at the bottom of the state plane, it ends with a circuit that's tangential to this M is equal to one line right at the end here. So it just barely gets zero voltage switching. You can also see that in the time domain waveforms that I'm getting about a half period of resonance, and I'm kind of flat up here at the top, just barely making it up 2VG. This is initially set up for a 2-to-1 conversion ratio, which makes things symmetric down here. If I went to a higher conversion ratio, say from 48 to 5, on that same operating point, when I get to something where I need a big negative current in order to just barely get ZVS, for this low conversion ratio, I need a lot of additional radius to make sure that I can resonate all the way up and achieve zero voltage switching. Bad impact on the waveforms is I get a lot of negative current in the system. You see, I have to keep the inductor current ramping down negative quite a bit, all the way down here to -4 amps, to get enough energy in that inductor such that when I shut off the devices, it'll resonate the voltage all the way up to VG, 48 volts in this case. Okay. So that's one script that I'll post. Just goes through and solves a single operating point based on this assumption of J4 is equal to zero and giving it some I1. So I have to give it some I1 because that lets me just solve through step by step all of these equations. Another approach, the second one here, is just to solve all of it at once. So the only difference in the second script is I set up I1 as all possible values between 0 and 50, and then solve vectors for all of these different parameters, all the different J's and angles, and then arbitrarily plotting some different things here. So if I run this, let's say for 48 to 5, this inductance and capacitance, this just gives me some plots looking at net performance over a range of different operating points. So I gave it a bunch of I1s, which directly correspond to T1s. So here I'm plotting versus T1. What is the output power? As T1 gets larger, I'm ramping up the current to a higher value and I'm getting more output power out of the system. You can see average output current increasing, but also the peak current increasing quite a bit. Staying significantly above the average output because I need this large ripple to maintain ZVS. Down here at the bottom, just looking at some other behaviors, just a handful of things I thought would be interesting to show, so decided to plot. Blue line is the switching frequency. See, as we go to higher output power, switching frequency drops because we are having longer intervals, getting ramping the current up even higher to get that higher output power. So I've got a really high switching frequency at low powers, and then it drops as I go to higher power. Purple line is just showing the ratio between the output current and the peak current in the inductor. You see as we go up in power, it kind of gets larger and eventually gets somewhere around a half. I go to very high power. Resonant intervals aren't so significant because the switching frequency is so low and my peak current is about double my output current. It means my ripple is 100%. As I get pretty far off to the right on this plot, this curve will approach 1/2, saying it just looks like a CCM converter with 100% ripple. Because my switching frequency is so low, these resonant intervals don't have a big impact. At low power, my switching frequency is pretty high. These resonant intervals have a big impact. Unfortunately, that means my ratio of peak current to output current gets even worse. Okay? It's I out divided by I peak, so a low ratio means I peak is many times higher than my average output current. Okay. The last one here in red is just T1 divided by T3, showing kind of a similar behavior. T1 and T3 are my two non-resonant intervals, my non-dead time intervals. If this was a CCM buck converter, I'd ignore the dead times, and T1 divided by T3 would be my duty cycle. This black line right here is just V over VG, 5 over 48, what the ideal duty cycle would be. You see, as we go to high power, we kind of approach that, but down in this region, we're significantly different from it. Okay. Just some behaviors to look at. That code assumes J4 is equal to zero still. Last one here, I'll get rid of that J4 is equal to zero assumption. So now I'm going to do a vector of all possible I1 values and all possible I4 values, make them into matrices, and then solve out a matrix of values for all of these J's, angles, output current, all the characteristics of the converter. for whatever I for and whatever I one I choose. So kind of anything I can do with this state plane. From that, what I get out of it are contour plots for different values of I1 and I4, and I can look at different parameters of the converter. Here, just showing a couple of them. Average output current, you can see is that on this line, going through the diagonal of this plot, average output current is nearly zero. This is wherever, example, if I4 is zero and I1 is zero, or at any point, if I4 and I1 are the same value. Saying this current and this current are the same, that gives me more or less a triangle wave centered around zero. So I get zero average output current. A little bit of distortion because I1 and I4 are on different sides of the state plane. If I go anywhere, you know, up here, I've got higher I1, lower I4, I'll get some positive output power. See, kind of straight, but then tilts a little bit as I get close to zero on I4. It's the effect of that resonance. If I have really high currents, these zero voltage switching intervals go so fast, they don't distort the waveforms much from just a triangle wave. If I get to small, try to get real close to the minimum ZVS current necessary, it starts to distort it, and it's noticeably not just an ideal triangle wave. Okay. This bottom one, I'm plotting now average output current and how much I4 I put into the system versus the switching frequency. Okay, so again, if I put zero I4, I can get zero voltage switching with the minimum additional conduction losses. But if I do that, in order to change the output current, I need to change the switching frequency. So I'd be saying I want to operate my converter along this axis here, keeping I4 is equal to zero, keeping my conduction losses low, then to change output current, switching frequency changes. I could, if I'm willing to sacrifice a little bit on conduction loss, instead follow one of these contours, which are ISO switching frequency contours. So on this line right here, see, what is it? Switching frequency is on the order of about 100 kilohertz, 0.1 in megahertz switching frequency. So if I follow this line, I'd be sticking right around 100 kilohertz, same switching frequency. And I could span from about 2 amps of output current up to about 15 amps of output current. But in doing so, I am changing the amount of negative current. So I'm keeping a constant switching frequency, getting kind of this triangle waveform, but just shifting the thing up and down. I'm kind of keeping not quite a constant ripple, but pretty close to a constant ripple, changing the switching frequency around. At some points I'll have minus 20 amps of negative current, plus 21 amps of positive current to get me 1 amp of average output. So I've got a lot of ripple, a lot of additional conduction losses at some powers. Okay. So I explained that a little bit too long. I've gone over on time. So I'm gonna go ahead and stop the recording.